Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
On the ground in Boston, following what authorities are calling a passenger disturbance. A federal security official says there's no indication of terrorism, even though the Associated Press initially quoted Logan Airport officials saying the woman who was taken from the plane was carrying Vaseline, a screwdriver, and notes referencing Al-Qaeda. Here Now reporter Fred Tice is at Logan Airport. Fred, what's going on there? We're seeing dramatic pictures on television of luggage spread out on the tarmac. What is going on?
Well, right now, the passengers are being held in the International Arrivals Building here at Logan Airport. The spokesman for the airport, Phil Orlandella, told us a little while ago that there will be another search of all the hand luggage, not the check luggage, but the hand luggage, and then passengers will be able to reboard and proceed on to Washington, Robin.
Now, this could take a while. What do we know about these conflicting reports about this one? What this one woman was carrying? Earlier, as we said, we were hearing reports that she had a screwdriver, water, Vaseline, matches perhaps, notes referencing Al-Qaeda. Where do those reports come from?
Well, those reports came from the Associated Press, and they are being contradicted by the Transportation Security Administration, which is in charge of security, obviously, here at the airport, by the Federal Security Director here at Logan Airport. And so we're not quite sure what's going on there.
Well, in the meantime, what about regular air traffic at Logan? Are flights being delayed?
It's a very quiet time of the day normally here at Logan, midday as it is in many American airports, and so there's not a lot of passenger traffic. Some of the discount carriers, AirTran, for example, are seeing some lines where people are beginning to line up for some of the flights. But, you know, most of the passengers here leave early in the morning or in the late afternoon, as they do in most airports. So right now, it's not disrupting much traffic.
That's WBUR reporter Fred Tice helping us out here on Here and Now here in Boston at Logan Airport. Fred, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
And now to London, where British authorities are making a case today for continuing to hold suspects in that alleged plot to blow up transatlantic flights from Britain to the U.S. Joining us from London, Newsweek reporter Emily Flynn Venkat. And Emily, tell us about the hearing. What is the British law about holding citizens? And what's the case the government's making?
Yeah, the police today are making a case to judges via video link, actually, to argue that they should be allowed to retain the 23 suspects they still have in custody for 7 days longer. Now, British law dictates that under the 2006 Terrorism Act, you can keep suspects in custody for a total of 28 days, but each hearing has to be held at a minimum of 7 days in order to extend that amount of time.
And you mentioned that the suspects, by the way, are appearing via video link. They're not there?
That's right. It's actually just lawyers for the suspects, and they will not be there. The police are making this case, and what they're trying to prove specifically is that by keeping these suspects for longer, they'll either be able to collect more evidence, they'll be able to preserve evidence they already have, or that they're awaiting results of some sort of analysis of data, be it DNA data or something.
Well, there have been some reports in the U.S., including one on NBC's Today show earlier today, that there's fear that authorities in Britain don't have enough evidence of an imminent attack. For instance, anonymous sources in the police department are saying some of the suspects didn't even have passports, and no airplane tickets were purchased.
Yeah, I've heard those reports, too, and obviously already the police have been forced to release one of the 24 suspects that they picked up on Wednesday. They released one of them on Friday. But it does seem like the investigation at this point is centering around one particular family. It's a Raouf family, and they're from Birmingham. The older brother in this family is a guy named Rashid Raouf. He's a 25-year-old man, and he was arrested in Pakistan last Tuesday, and his younger brother was then arrested the day after in this big swoop across Britain. His name is Tayyib Raouf. He's 22 years old. And media reports have recently also been focusing on the father in this family, a man named Abdul Raouf, who's also currently in Pakistan. and is the one of the founding directors of a charity called Crescent Relief, which sends tens of thousands of dollars to Pakistan every year.
Well, and to counter that, family and friends of this family, I believe, have released a tape. Is this the young man who's in the tape that was released? It shows him working in a store.
Yes.
It's a security camera.
This is Tayyib Rauf. He's the 22-year-old younger brother of Rashid, who was Rashid was arrested in Pakistan. Tayyib was arrested in Birmingham. And yeah, I mean, what his family and friends are saying is that he simply worked for the family's confectionery business, making cakes. He'd drop them off in these big white vans and then pick up money from local shopkeepers. And so they're all saying they were these devout family, very friendly, very, you know, all had beards, very devout and very ordinary.
We're speaking to Newsweek reporter Emily Flynn Venkat from London. One last question about investigators making their case today to keep the suspects for a longer time. Mm-hmm. What happens if, in fact, the judge or whoever is holding the hearing turns them down? Do people just walk?
Yes, that's right. I mean, they have to. They're currently allowed only to keep them until a bit later this evening. And if the judge does not grant further leave to keep them, then they will be allowed to walk.
Newsweek reporter Emily Flynn Venkat in London. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we turn now to Rafi Ron. He's president and CEO of New Age Security Solutions. He's also former head of airport security in Israel. Since 9/11, he's worked with a number of airports, including Logan here in Boston, to improve their security systems. He joins us from his office in Rockville, Maryland, to talk to us about, you know, many thoughts about airport security. But Rafi, we want to ask you first, since we have the story coming out of Boston about a plane diverted from London. It was traveling from London to Washington, diverted to Boston's Logan Airport. A woman apparently on the plane causing a disturbance. Earlier reports that she was carrying a screwdriver. She had water. The transportation officials saying she has no ties to terrorism. But what do you make of all of this? Is this just the stuff of, you know, the wake of an alleged terrorist plot?
No, I think that it has to be put back in proportion from the information that was made public until now. I think my main impression is that we're dealing here with an unruly passenger, something that air crews have been facing from time to time all through the commercial aviation history. And it's not the first time that a flight was diverted and landed as a result of sometimes violent behavior of a passenger. The questions that are being raised about what this specific passenger have carried, including some Vaseline and some other items, still have to be looked at more carefully before we jump into conclusions about failures in the London screening process, because when you speak about a screwdriver, that could be something as big as the small screwdrivers that we're using to fix our glasses.
Mm. Which are allowed.
And so on. So yeah. I think that we need to look at this into the details further.
And yet there is concern about security, obviously, and there are other reports, one about a 12-year-old boy managing to board a plane at Gatwick Airport in Britain yesterday without a passport, without a ticket or a boarding pass. He was detected by the cabin crew. He was taken off before the flight took off.
Yes.
So it seems to be nearly impossible to keep these one or two incidents from happening.
It's true. I think that the incident with the boy in Gatwick is a little bit more serious in security terms or exposing weaknesses in the system than the one we had this morning on the United flight. But this is something that we must learn to live with, that there is always a certain percentage of failure in every operation. No operation is a foolproof operation. The thing is that we have to make sure that that those failures would be accidental, and the conclusions will be drawn in order to prevent future similar failures. And we must make sure that it will not be an inherent failure that the terrorists can learn about and in advance and build up their operational plan on, like the failure to detect liquid explosives that was the basis of the terrorist plan in London.
Well, let's talk about some of the safeguards that are being instituted here in the States. For instance, this week, all airline passengers are going to have to remove their shoes and have them x-rayed. The Transportation Security Administration defending the practice, saying it's an effective way to detect improvised bombs. But the Department of Homeland Security contradicts that. They have a report that says x-ray images don't provide the information to detect explosives. So shoe screening, start there.
Well, I think that they, there's some misunderstandings here. I don't think the TSA claimed that by x-raying the shoes they can detect the presence of explosives, because a x-ray simply doesn't do that. But what they did say was that by looking at the shoe and detecting irregularities in the structure of the shoe, there's more than a fair chance that a screener would be aware that something is concealed in the shoe.
Well, Rafi, I have to interrupt you for just a second, because Kip Hawley, who's Transportation Security Administration chief, did say at his news conference at Reagan that screening shoes by x-ray is an effective way of identifying any anomaly, including explosives. So, I'm wondering.
Well, I think that we shouldn't catch him by the word, because I think that what he meant was that by identifying the anomalies, this would lead to further search of the shoe, and this would expose if there are explosive materials there. But I think that the more important conclusion that we should draw from all this is that focusing on shoes and turning them into our main story, I think is a mistake. I think what we did after the Richard Reed case, the shoe bomber case, when we started to focus on shoes, seemed to a lot of us as a very limited expression of imagination, as I think we all understand that the explosive devices can be concealed not only in shoes, but in other items, and can be carried on different parts of the body rather than just on a person's feet.
Rafi Iran, security advisor. I'm so glad you mentioned Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber, because I want you to, when we come back from a brief break we're just about to take, I want you to explain to us how officials in Israel treated Richard Reed very differently from the way he was treated in other countries prior to his flying from Britain to the U.S. with devices in his shoe. He was detected at an Israeli airport and through a system that you very much advocate, and you put an air marshal on the plane sitting next to him while he flew. We want to find out more about the profiling that's done in Israel and why you advocate it here in the States, but we're going to do that if we take a quick break, okay?
Okay.
Come back right back with Rafi Iran, president and CEO of New Age Security Solutions, also former head of airport security in Israel. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Head of airport security in Israel. And Rafi, I want to talk to you about aviation security and profiling. You spoke before the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure here in the U.S., a subcommittee on aviation. And this was in 2002. And you said at the time that there were two elements that lead to airplane terrorism. There's a person with a hostile intention and a weapon. And that the U.S. is focused too much on trying to find the weapon. You urge officials in the U.S. to spend more time looking for the person. Tell us why.
Yeah, this is true because we figured out in Israel already back in the 70s when we started struggling with the aviation security issue that the definition of weapon and the explosive devices are really extremely wide, and the only way to detect these is through a very, very thorough search that I would describe as a search at forensic level. There's no way that you can subject all passengers to that. So we developed a tool which is based on profiling techniques, and I'd like to mention, to emphasize, it's not a racial profiling, because the issue of race and ethnicity is not at the center of it.
How is it not though? Explain that, because people obviously, you know, predictably think it is. How is it not?
Well, first of all, it is not, because we have learned the hard way at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. When we were attacked, Ben-Gurion Airport was attacked twice, once by a group of Japanese terrorists, and the second time by a German terrorist, a blonde hair, blue-eyed.
And there's also the very famous story of Anne Mary Murphy, who was an Irish...
Anne Mary Murphy, exactly. And I can list you some other names that you may not be familiar with, of non-Middle Eastern terrorists that acted against Israeli targets and Israeli aviation, or attempted to do so.
And we should just say Anne Mary Murphy was the young Irish girl whose Palestinian boyfriend put her on the plane, and unbeknownst to her, she was carrying a bag with a bomb in it.
Yes, and I think that, by the way, Anne Marie Murphy is a perfect example of how this system works, because, as you just mentioned, Anne Marie Murphy, a 20-something year-old Irish pregnant girl, is as far as one can be from the expected ethnic or racial profile of a Palestinian terrorist. One could expect to act against an El Al airplane. Yet, when she came to the airport and she was interviewed by an Israeli security person who's been very well trained in these interview techniques, he, after a short conversation with her that did not last more than 10 minutes in her case, because things started, question marks started to develop at a very early stage in this interview, so the interview was extended, and after about 10 minutes, it was obvious that she is concealing the truth about her journey and about herself. While at the airport, you cannot, under any circumstances, run a full-scale interrogation, and you may not even want to do that, to reach a conclusion if someone is a terrorist himself. But the conclusion you can reach is that this person, the probability of being involved in terrorism might be greater than others. So it led in London to a very thorough search of her bag that exposed the fact that there was a very sophisticated explosive device concealed in the bag. So, I mean, in this case, not only that the profile was completely different, but even she herself did not know that she was carrying a bomb, but just by the fact that she did not manage to keep away some of the truth about herself and about the purpose of her journey, that led to the discovery of the bomb.
So when you say profiling, you're talking about, in particular, this person-to-person interview that can last 90 seconds or as long as 20 minutes. It's a systematic real-time investigation of the passenger. But is that realistic? Can that be? I mean, how do you know who to interview?
Well,
everyone gets interviewed, but how do you know how long to go?
Well, I can tell you that in Israel, when I ran security at Tel Aviv Ben-Gurion Airport, on a peak day, we used to carry out close to 50,000 such interviews a day.
And part of this is because who's doing the interviews? Who are the people who work at the airport?
The people that work at the airport, the security personnel at the airport, are highly qualified young people that have been selected on the basis of above average intelligence, strong personality, and some other criteria.
We understand that the training isn't in the hands of the airport, but in the hands of the Secret Service of the country. And there's been suggestions here that the training of the security at airports might be adjusted. But there's also suggestions that the U.S. airport should expand a program that trains screeners to look for unusual behavior in passengers that might indicate malicious intent. This is called SPOT, screening passengers by observation technique. It's being used in 12 airports in the U.S., but just briefly, in the time we have, Rafi, what would security agents look for?
Well, I'm a little bit reluctant to discuss the details of the cues that we're looking for obvious reasons, because that would only make it easier for terrorists to prepare themselves. So with all the media attention during the last few days on these techniques, I think we should restrain ourselves from discussing the details of what we're looking for. But what I should say is that while SPOT is a program that TSA is started to implement with its screeners, there is the behavior pattern recognition that was initiated by some of the airports, including Logan, San Francisco, Miami, and Minneapolis and Paul. It's a program that we developed at Logan Airport, it trains the law enforcement officers as well as airport employees in detecting suspicious behavior and responding to it correctly.
Rafi Ron, President and CEO of New Age Security Solutions, also former head of airport security in Israel. We'll have to have you back on a day when news isn't breaking as fast as it is today. But Rafi, we welcome you as always to talk about your thoughts on increasing airport security in the U.S.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, a plane from London to Washington has been diverted to Boston's Logan Airport. Officials say no sign of terrorism. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Museum of Science, Boston.
We are for the first time hearing more than 1,600 emergency calls made that day from the World Trade Center towers in New York. Newly discovered tapes that the fire department says were an oversight. Most of the recordings are of fire department employees, including 21 firefighters who died that day. Because they are public employees, their entire calls are being released. But part of what one civilian trapped in the towers said to a dispatcher is heard. Melissa Doy called from the 83rd floor of the South Tower.
Please,
I'm going to die, aren't I?
No.
I'm going to die.
Ma'am, say your prayers. Or we're not.
I'm going to die.
We're going to think positive because you got to help each other get off the floor.
I'm going to die. Stay calm.
God. You're doing a good job, ma'am.
It's so hot. I'm burning up.
And now, according to a report on the New York Times website, Melissa Doy apparently died later while on the phone. This is the third time in a year that emergency recordings from the World Trade Towers have been made public. Joining us on the line from New York is Fred Mogul, reporter for our NPR sister station, WNYC. And Fred, I am guessing that these tapes are very difficult to listen to.
Well, it is. I mean, sad to say, we've obviously lived with September 11th for 5 years. We've lived with these recordings, as you mentioned, over the past year. We've had two previous releases, which isn't to say we're getting inured to it, but it is always difficult, even when you only hear half of the conversation. There is one exception, actually, and the first and perhaps most poignant that we've heard yet, which is part of Melissa Doy. Whom you just referred to, we hear her speaking for part of it only because in the courtroom, in the sentencing phase of the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker, they did, during the sentencing of him, play a full excerpt where you hear both her and the dispatcher. And it is very heartrending. The dispatcher is trying to tell her to hold on, help is on the way. This is a common refrain that all the dispatchers were pretty much telling everyone. There's only two exceptions that we've gleaned in the prior batch where they did tell people to vacate. That was something that the fire chiefs had ordered and requested, but it didn't actually filter down to the 9/11 and EMS dispatchers.
City lawyers argued that other calls are way too emotional to be released and without the family's consent in particular.
Right. It's a privacy issue. The families have had different feelings about it. There's been a very vocal group that notwithstanding the pain and anguish, does actually want it out there. And they do believe that there is a benefit, aside from the emotional factor, figuring out what happened when, what dispatchers knew, what they didn't, what was told to people. And the group of vocal families has been working with a couple public safety advocates.
And what have you been hearing on the tapes so far? Are you hearing any new clues that might give us a sense of what happened that day?
So far, not. I mean, I should say that there are 1,600 plus calls. There's in excess of 23 hours. It just takes a while to get through in all its horror. And so we're kind of sifting now. We're getting, you know, little glimpses. It takes a while for anyone to assemble what all these elliptical moments add up to.
And Fred, what is the fire department saying about what they're calling an oversight? As we know, the New York Times and 9/11 families sued for the release of these tapes. A court ordered that they had to be released. 130 were back in March after New York City lost a court battle to keep them private. But how is it that 1,600 went unnoticed?
Well, first of all, I should say that from the very beginning, the city fought the release of any of these transmissions on the grounds of privacy and dignity, not only to the media and to the families, but to federal agencies. This group here should have been released earlier, as you mentioned. The fire department ordered some of its underlings to carefully go through the tapes and effectively sort of release the bare minimum. And the people who did this, who put forth the tapes, apparently, you know, were overzealous, at least in the telling of the fire department. And it might not have actually even been noticed that 1,600 calls, however massive an amount that is, hadn't been released, except that there was a dropped call, and I don't recall whether it was the fire department officials themselves or the people who listened to it who said, well, what happened to that one call? It suggested that there were other things missing, and they went back and reviewed what the stipulations were from the court, what the orders to the underlings were, and it seems that, again, that they had not implemented this appropriately.
One last question. Fred Mogul, again, from WNYC in New York. We talked about, you know, a call from a victim, someone trapped in the building, but many of the calls were from firefighters. What essentially is the basis of their calls, most of their calls?
Well, some of those firefighters were off-duty people calling in to see where they needed to report to, and others were, like earlier groups, people trying to communicate with the dispatchers to find out where they needed to go, where people were at, and whether and when they should vacate themselves. And they got very mixed signals. People were transferred and calls were dropped. And so it just was completely chaotic.
Fred Mogul, a reporter for WNYC in Manhattan, talking about today's release of phone calls made on 9/11. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this note, from now on, we may have to say the 12 planets of the solar system, not the 9 planets. How weird is that? But either way, Pluto will still be one. A committee of the International Astronomical Union announced today that they want to add 3 more planets, Ceres, Charon, Xena, to the list of planets, but they are not going to take away Pluto. For more, we want to touch down with our friend Kelly Beattie of Sky and Telescope magazine. And Kelly, this all started with a debate over Pluto, didn't it?
That's right. And then last year, when astronomers announced the discovery of an even more distant object that appears to be larger than Pluto, it brought the whole thing to a boil, and they really did have to get down and decide one way or the other.
Is Pluto a planet? Is it?
Well, by this definition, it would be. They've come up with a pretty simple definition. The crux of it has to be that it has to be big enough for gravity to bring it into a spherical shape. And Pluto certainly qualifies. So does its moon, Charon. And then Ceres, which was the first asteroid discovered back in 1801, was at first thought to be a planet, then it was demoted to an asteroid, and now it's going to be a planet again.
And we understand by these definitions, dozens more could be added. How are astronomers feeling about this?
Yeah, I wouldn't get too comfortable with the 12, because there are 12 more objects, possibly creating 24 planets within just a couple of months that are under discussion. Astronomers are pretty mixed. I think a lot of people are disappointed with, given the simplicity, it causes a real mess in trying to sort out what's what.
Not to mention we have to redo all those globey things at schools and museums and all the posters on the ceiling. It all has to be redone.
I heard this morning from an astronomer who's working on a video for children that's just about done, and now he has to incorporate all these new objects, one of which, Xena, doesn't have an official name yet. So what's he supposed to do?
Wait. Kelly Beattie, planetary specialist for Sky and Telescope magazine on adding more planets to our solar system. It is kind of exciting, though. Kelly, thanks.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. During our ongoing coverage of the war between Israel and Hezbollah militants, we invited in guests with many different perspectives, which prompted this email from Penny Kolb of Ewing, New Jersey. She writes, "Many talking heads are missing the big point here. The overall problem boils down to this. If Hezbollah stops shooting, there will be no more violence. If Israel stops shooting, there will be no more Israel." Well, one of our talking heads was Barbara Newman, co-author of Lightning Out of Lebanon, Hezbollah Terrorists on American Soil. She explained how Hezbollah raised money in the U.S. through the sale of contraband and by siphoning off charitable donations. Well, Larry Lopez of Cambridge, Massachusetts, found the conversation interesting, but writes, "I was puzzled to hear you identify Newman as an author and a former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Isn't she also a senior fellow at a right-wing think tank called the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies? I would have viewed her remarks very differently if I'd been given this context, or for that matter, if I'd been given context that she was funded by Iran or by a liberal group. I'm not saying you shouldn't have aired her, but I would have liked to know about her possible bias." Point taken, Larry. That was our editing error. Dave Daggett of Berkeley, California also wrote, "After our report on the terror suspects in the alleged London airplane plot, some of those suspects are so-called homegrown or British-born." And Dave writes, "What's so hard to understand about religious fundamentalism seeping into Western society? Why do we continue to avoid the core issue of addressing religious fundamentalism of all stripes in our modern world, actively discouraging them and providing alternatives?" Well, often it's not what we say, it's how we say it. On a recent newscast on our program, we talked about allegations, since completely discredited, of a plot to blow up a bridge in Michigan. We called that bridge the Mackinac. Why not? It's spelled M-A-C-K-I-N-A-C. Mackinac, right? Wrong. We heard from many Michiganders, including Steve Silverman of Detroit. Steve, how do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it just like the British overcoat, Mackinac.
Well, it gets even worse because the Mackinac Bridge with a C apparently bridges the Straits of Mackinac with a C from Mackinac City with a W
to another city.
Is it an Indian name? Or?
It's shortened from Michilimackinac. There's a fort in Mackinac City with a W that's Michilimackinac with a C. It's supposed to be an Ottawa tribe name, but no one knows why the French who first got there spelled it the way they spelled it.
But it gets even better. In your email, you reference Youpers. What are Youpers?
Youpers are people who live in the UP.
UP?
UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Michigan has two peninsulas, and that's what the bridge spans, the lower and the upper.
Well, glad to clear up that. And this, a couple of you, including Jeff Igo, who teaches at the University of Michigan at Dearborn, thought that I used the football term touchdown to describe the death of Israelis in a Hezbollah assault. I did not. I did say touchdown in the Middle East, but rest assured I meant the airplane touchdown, as in a brief touchdown or brief report, before taking off to another subject. As I'm about to do. You know how sometimes people on the radio have those annoying habits that just drive you crazy? Oh, wait, that would be me. Erica Taylor of Foxborough, Massachusetts writes, "I would like to respectfully request that Robin Young not make noises when the guests she is interviewing are talking. The grunt-like sounds she makes are annoying." I mean, yes, you're quite right. Less grunting. And finally, Louis McConey of Mesa, Arizona, wrote after our visit with Ian Anderson, frontman for Jethro Tull, now touring with U.S. Symphonies, "Serendipity," says Louis. "I've been on a Jethro Tull kick the last few days after finally acquiring the Aqualung CD. It was a blast to hear him. Thank you." As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at H-E-R-E-N-O-W.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. That's it. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. perceptions or rock and roll. Well, now baby boomers are apparently changing the way we die. That's according to reporter Lisa Takauchi Cullen. She says the options for end-of-life arrangements vary in ways our grandparents could never have imagined. We can have our remains attached to coral reefs, or we can choose to be buried in a model fire engine. We can be turned into $1,000 diamonds, or invite our mourners to dance the tango around our urn. In her new book, Remember Me, A Lively Tour of the New American Way of Death, Lisa Takauchi Cullen straps her newborn baby on her back and goes in search of the new funerals and the people she calls entrepreneurs who provide these services. And she joins us now from the Carnegie Studios in New York. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we should be clear, you say at the outset you're not trying to rewrite the classic Jessica Mitford expose of funeral homes in 1963, The American Way of Death. You're just trying to figure out what everyone's doing, but one thing you do see is that it's an industry in flux, funeral directors losing ground to funeral planners.
By no means am I trying even to follow in the footsteps of Jessica Mitford and her wonderful exposé of the industry. It was a wonderful piece of journalism. However, what I was interested in was how American consumers are reinventing this industry. You mentioned the baby boomers having, you know, made over everything from sex to hairstyles to music. Well, I think death sort of just came next on the to-do list. And here they are. They're beginning to hit 60, and they're typically now becoming involved in the funerals of their parents, not so much each other yet. But that's getting them thinking about what they would want for their own services. And they're demanding things that the industry has really never even heard of before. And so, yes, it's giving way to a breed of what the industry is calling funeral planners. Now, that's a mix between a funeral director and a party planner. And they're people who are going to have to learn how to do celebrations of life and not just mournings of death.
Well, for instance, there might be the person who had a dance studio who wants there to be a tango party at her funeral. Just to give another example, one of the women you interviewed for this book had her husband turned into a diamond. Tell us a little bit more about that process.
I had heard about this company. It's called Life Gem, and it's based in Chicago. But I had always thought it a really off-the-wall way to commemorate your dead, in that you have your ashes. It's 8 ounces of cremated remains, called cremains in industry speak, that are compressed, and the carbon is extracted from your ashes to be turned through an artificial process into an actual genuine diamond. To be honest, I had sort of sniggered at this and thought it very kooky, until I went to visit a woman in Manhattan who had had this done with her beloved husband's remains. And I sat with her as we opened the FedEx box and pulled out this beautiful jewelry box in which sat a gorgeous half-carat yellow diamond that was her husband. And it was a powerful emotional moment.
Well, and who knew that you can get a casket shaped like a lobster? There's a guy who runs an online website and wears an I Put the Fun in Funerals t-shirts. Or the Christian fundamentalists are part of a growing number of people looking for green funerals. Tell us a little more about these environmentally friendly funerals.
I went down to Westminster, South Carolina, to a place called Ramsey Creek Preserve, which is the very first green cemetery in the United States. And what it is a place in which one can be buried in a shallow hole, typically without even a casket, just wrapped in a shroud, and you become, you know, essentially fertilizer for wildflowers. So by designating land a cemetery, then in most states there are regulations in place that forbid or at least put up some barriers toward development over that property. So you're doing two good things. Your body is helping the surrounding soil around you, and also you're helping to preserve the land above you.
And for those, you know, looking to be literal, you're literally going from dust to dust.
You are, and I think that's what appeals to many Christians.
You interviewed a woman who decided to have her body preserved by plastination and displayed as part of Gunther von Hagen's human body exhibits. That exhibit is at Boston's Museum of Science right now. So remind those who haven't seen it, these are, I don't know how to describe it, you know, bodies that are turned into sculpture.
It is a made-up word, plastination, that the anatomist, the German anatomist Gunther von Hagen, came up with. And what he means by it is that the corpse is infused with polymers, with plastics that make it pliable and also preserve it pretty much forevermore. And what he has done in this exhibit, as you know if you've seen it, is pose whole human bodies in sort of controversial ways. There might be a pregnant woman reclining, for instance, or a man riding a horse. And that's struck some people as, you know, gross, others as distasteful, and others as beautiful, as I found when I met a woman from West L.A. while the exhibit was out there. She had gone to see this exhibit, and she sat down afterwards and offered her body up as a body donor.
Another unusual way to spend eternity, to attach yourself to a coral reef?
There is a movement, as you know, if you live along the waterline, to reinstate reefs along many states, by, you know, through the use of artificial reefs. So these are sort of blobs of concrete, essentially, that act as artificial reefs. One can have their loved one's cremated remains mixed in to this concrete blob, really. They call them reef balls, and they are placed in the ocean. There is a viewing ceremony. There is a ceremony as they are placed in the ocean in which the families go out on boats and watch as the reef ball is placed and there are horns sounded. And again, it's one of those things that you hear about and you think, wow, that's really weird. And then you actually participate in and find extremely moving.
Mm-hmm. We should say there are people going for very traditional burials, but with a modern twist. Do you write about coffins that are called fantastic afterlife vehicles? A beer fridge?
I think the casket industry itself is going to be one of the subsets of the very large funeral and burial industry that's going to change dramatically over the coming years. One of the major trends that's rocking the casket industry is cremation. Right now, 29% of American deaths result in cremation. Within 20 years, that's going to be 48%. So half of all bodies that die are going to be cremated rather than buried whole. However, for those who do decide to do that, they might want a casket that better represents their lives. So you have all sorts of options. The great thing today is you can find a lot of this stuff online. But for instance, you can buy a motorcycle a casket in which the designs are all having to do with Harley Davidsons and the knobs look like, you know, gears on a motorcycle.
Well, taking all of this in, we want to be clear. Do you think that these new approaches to death reflect less reverence about death, or are people actually maybe becoming more emotionally connected to it?
I have to say that among the families, and they were, again, mostly baby boomers that I spoke to, when they spoke of their own death, yes, there was an irreverence. There were talks of skydiving parties and, you know, in crazy celebrations. But when they spoke of the deaths of their loved ones, it was still a very emotional and tragic and difficult thing. It's not going to change for humans that when we lose someone whom we love dearly, when that person is gone from our old world, that it's a tragic and horrible and crushing time for us. And I confronted this myself because at the very end of my reporting, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Mm. And I found myself wondering if I lost this woman who I loved, would I have it in me to throw a party? I don't think that I would. On the other hand, I hope that when I get to an age where I'm considering this for myself, that I'm able to think of this last rite of life as a celebration rather than a mourning.
Well, but then you don't know what your daughter will want, do you? For you.
Exactly, and that's actually a very good point, because in the end, it's up to the living. It's up to the next of kin.
Lisa Takeuchi Cullen, her new book is called Remember Me, A Lively Tour of the New American Way of Death. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at the future of Lebanon as the military